Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. Despite having really lovely people like Jill Hewitt around, it's very important for you to know that Greenbelt is a very dangerous place. One minute, you are down in the mud with everybody else, claiming that you've only agreed to come here because Billy Bragg was on the main stage. And then 7 years later, they put you on the talks program because they think you've got something to say. I suspect this is perhaps one of the very many meanings of Greenbelt Life Begins. So thank you for coming, by the way, especially all of you that I don't even recognize. So, confessions of a road-crossing, border-walking, interfaithing Jew. Okay, and it gets worse. I'm married to an Anglican priest. Yeah, it's that bad. She's just down here, Anne. And I'm a Jew writing very publicly as a Jew with religious Jewish convictions about my criticisms, not just about the actions of the State of Israel, but about the entire Zionist enterprise. So some of you are probably here to see what this kind of bag of contradictions actually looks like, and maybe to ask me how much does the therapy cost each month to be living like this. And, you know, what about their poor four children? How thoroughly messed up must they be? You can ask them because they're here. I get them to stand up, and they can do a talk as well at the end. So how do you set out on an untraditional path? Where does it all begin? What do you lose and what do you gain along the way? And finally, does the job come with any particular responsibilities? It's all of these questions I will attempt to provide you with some answers by way of autobiography. The personal is always political, as well as religious and spiritual, as you will discover with this story. Okay, where to start? Okay, how about my primary school in southeast London? You see, I was already growing up on the wrong side of the river as far as the Jewish community is concerned, so I was guaranteed to be going astray. Okay, I'm 10 years old, and I'm standing in the school morning assembly with my palms pressed together, and I'm agonizing with myself about whether it's okay to join in with saying the Lord's Prayer. Okay, it's true, I used to really worry about this. Which Lord were we actually talking about? Which Lord were we praying to? Was it theirs or was it mine? It was all very confusing until I had a kind of light bulb moment. And I realized that if Jesus was teaching the prayer to his disciples while he was still alive and well and on earth, and if the first line was, Our Father who art in heaven, then the prayer might be being said by their Lord Jesus, but it was definitely about my Lord God. So what a relief. Okay, I was okay. I could join in. Now, I wasn't breaking any rules, and I couldn't get into trouble with anyone else, Jewish or Christian, by joining in. Now, the fact that my favorite hymn at school was Lord of the Dance by Sidney Carter was slightly more problematic. And I did feel slightly guilty about liking it so much. So here was this sort of athletic activist inviting Jesus, who was kind of dancing around and dissing the scribes and the Pharisees, healing the sick and raising the dead from the grave. By the way, these were the same scribes and Pharisees that, according to my Hebrew classes on a Sunday, were in fact the cutting radical edge of first century Judaism. But, you know, never mind that for the moment. Carter's Jesus was almost irresistible because he was doing his thing to the accompaniment of an irresistible tune. Even the crucifixion was up-tempo. You know, as they cut him down, he leapt right up, for I am the Lord of the Dance, said he. Now, I knew then, though, that dancing with Jesus, and indeed anyone else for that matter, was not really my thing, either kind of literally or metaphorically. Now, looking back, I can see how these moments at school were my first sort of visceral interfaith encounters, moments when institutional and cultural suspicions, for me, began to be broken down. Now, by the time I was in my teens, I'd also discovered that I rather liked being on the edge of things, okay, or inhabiting the space between two places. never the complete insider, willing to join in but kind of reluctant to join up. Now, this can look like a kind of pathological lack of commitment, and Anne has pointed this out to me on a number of occasions over the years. But in my book, I'm trying to persuade you that this is a virtue, okay? Now, I've now accepted that this is actually my preferred state of being, and I like to think it has something to do with me being fully inhabiting the Jewish diaspora sensibility. Okay, Jews have always been the perennial and expert outsiders, sometimes allowed to join in and sometimes not. And keeping a self-distance, a safe distance at all times, becomes a self-defense mechanism, both physically and mentally. In the end, it becomes the most comfortable place to be. It's probably why I ended up being a journalist. It means you can be at the center of things and knowing what's going on without actually being in the spotlight or having any kind of responsibility. That's what journalism is, you know. Yeah. Okay, so I've worked it all out. Who needs a therapist? Okay, like Jesus in Lord of the Dance, I'm going to jump ahead a bit. Okay, in 1985, I got back from my first visit to Israel to start life as a student at Manchester University. That trip to Israel is a whole other talk on its own. Nearly 30 years later, I think I'm still unpacking the religious and spiritual and intellectual political luggage that I brought back with me from that journey. However, let me just tell you one thing about that particular trip. I found myself on a two-month program that was designed to attract assimilated Jews from the West to modern Jewish orthodoxy in Israel. And the program was located in a small town called Sfat, in Hebrew, or Safed in Arabic. It's in northern Galilee. And Sfat had become the center of Jewish mysticism in the 16th century, and it still had a kind of alarming air of spiritual intensity about it. And this was heightened by the number of Hasidic Jews who came to pay their respects to long-dead Jewish mystics whose souls had been on fire with religious fervor. Anyway, so there I was. And we went on a two-day trek through northern Galilee, and I promised solemnly to the leader of the program, who was an imposing American called Aaron Botzer. And I said to him that whatever else I did when I got back to the United Kingdom, I would make sure that I married a nice Jewish girl. Manchester, as many of you probably know, has probably the largest Jewish student population in the UK. So finding the right Jewish partner really should have been quite easy. But instead, as can happen at university, I fell in with a dangerous crowd and defaulted to my preferred role as edgy outsider. And the hotbed of radicalism that I found myself allied to was called Christians in Politics. But to be honest, the real attraction was a fellow student from my politics tutorial who'd invited me to hear that week's guest speaker. Now, some of the people in that Christians in Politics group are actually in the room today. And I have to say, you look just as seditious now as you did a quarter of a century ago. Either that, or it's just the fact that none of us have washed for 3 days. It might have been something to do with it as well. So my fellow tutorial student, she's here as well. That's because we've been married for 20 years. So thank you for the invitation, Anne. And you've kind of been alerting me to interesting opportunities ever since, of which more later. So Anne and I have been involved in Christian-Jewish dialogue for approaching 30 years. Actually, we don't really call it interfaith dialogue anymore, which would be a far too grand a thing to describe what we do when we're just kind of like unstacking the dishwasher or something. We just talk about stuff that's important to us. And actually, I'm not even sure that we talk about it that much anymore. We just kind of get on with it. So neither of us would have guessed all those years ago, when both of us were questioning our respective beliefs and upbringing, that by now Anne would be a Church of England priest and I would be using social media to defend Judaism's ethical tradition. And Anne and I have both been on something of a spiritual journey through all of these years. And throughout that journey, each of us has found guidance, nourishment, inspiration in each other's faith traditions, and through the very process of having to look closely at our own religious heritage. Through all of this, Anne has remained Christian and I've remained Jewish, with both of us feeling more affirmed and secure in our respective commitments than we were a quarter of a century ago. Anne and I don't claim to have all the answers when it comes to Christian-Jewish dialogue or Christian-Jewish relationships, far from it. In fact, not having all of the answers turns out to be an important place to get to when you're having an interreligious conversation. The really important thing is to simply listen to each other without feeling defensive about our respective traditions. Without denying differences of emphasis and interpretation, we've consciously chosen to emphasize the interconnections between Judaism and Christianity, rather than the points of disagreement and departure. Throughout 25 years together, each of us has learned to walk along borders and travel to a religious foreign land, occasionally negotiate hostile territory, and often take on the role of an ambassador from a neighboring kingdom. Together, we've had to find our way through various religious rites of passage, starting with our wedding, which was in a Quaker meeting house in the Lake District in 1992. There's a lot to be said for a service based on silence when you're trying to keep both sides of the family happy. That was an inspired decision that we had there. Okay, each circumcision, baptism, priesthood have all had to be worked through, along with understanding and celebrating the annual cycle of religious festivals. Each Friday night, we sit down together with our four children, with Rosie, Evie, Solomon, and Micah, at the kitchen table, and we light Sabbath candles, and we share bread and wine, and we welcome in the Jewish Sabbath. Sometimes we're also fractious and tired from the week that has ended, that the simple ceremony requires considerable effort from all of us, but nobody wants to give it up, because it brings us together at the end of the week with prayers that allow us to pause and give thanks and think about the lives of others that we've encountered or news that we've heard about during that week. Each Sunday morning, we find ourselves at our large parish church in Kendal in Cumbria, where Anne has been the curate for the last 2 years. Now, after attending Church of England services for nearly 14 years or so, I've learned how to worship in a setting different to that from which I grew up with words and music that I once found alienating and even threatening and certainly uncomfortable with. Apart, of course, from the Sidney Carter hymns, which I'm fine about. I've discovered how not to let specific liturgy or theological conceptions trip me up. I sometimes think of it as praying in a foreign language. For me, all religious language is just our flawed attempt to put into words things that in the final reckoning defy the perfect human articulation. Sometimes the words work and sometimes they don't. Sometimes the same words will work 1 week but not the next, and that feels like a good thing to me. If nobody has the ultimate form of words, then perhaps we can just accept that we are all straining to reach the same things, dealing with the same concerns, and responding with varying degrees of success to the meaning of our existence. As you can guess, I'm something of a religious pluralist. Now, I could say more here about my views on religious plurality and my understanding of Jesus and the challenges of interfaith dialogue, and indeed what it is to sort of bring up four children in the household, the family that we've created. I've written about some of that elsewhere, and I want to spend a bit more time giving you some new material. So let's move on to Israel. I want to share with you what happens when a road-crossing and border-walking Jew puts himself outside of his community and not just through intermarriage. In some ways, kind of intermarriage is that's kind of more easy for Jewish families to cope with than it is kind of stepping out of line on Israel, which is a kind of interesting thing in itself. Okay, this has been something of a lengthy journey as well. My earliest memory of being conscious of something called the State of Israel is probably from about 1973. I was in synagogue with my family. It was the Yom Kippur service, the most solemn day in the Jewish calendar. The attendance is kind of equivalent to combining Christmas and Easter into one service. And suddenly a young man interrupted the proceedings, still wearing his prayer shawl and his kippah, his head covering, to tell us that Egyptian tanks were rolling across the Sinai Desert and it looked like a full-scale assault on Israel was underway. And I could feel the kind of collective anxiety that the news created, and it added this kind of intensity to the remainder of the service prayers. And even though I was far too young to really understand what was happening, from that moment on, I realized I was trying to make sense of Israel and what Israel meant to me and those closest to me. So Israel was always there, sometimes in the foreground, sometimes in the background. I'd heard of the Palestinians, but only in the context of terrorism, hijacking, and most memorably the daring rescue of Jewish hostages by an elite Israeli commando unit from Entebbe Airport in Uganda. So Israel was a country, the very existence of which we could take enormous pride in. Moving forward a little bit to the Lebanon War in 1982, now that alerted me to the emerging Israeli peace movement and the growing settlements on the West Bank. But at the time, I have to say, 1982, I was more interested in following the Falklands War. At university, as the first modern Palestinian uprising was erupting on the occupied streets of Gaza and the West Bank, I attempted to follow this intifada as best I could through the journals that were subscribed to in John Ryland's student library at Manchester University. So this was without the benefit of the intranet and email and Twitter and Facebook and electronic newsletters. So I attempted to follow what was going on through the pages of Foreign Affairs magazine and the New York Review of Books and Commentary magazine and the UK's Jewish Quarterly. And I began to read Israeli writers like Amos Oz and David Grossman. And I was beginning to understand that there was a Palestinian story. There was an alternative narrative that was different to the one that I had absorbed without the slightest effort, kind of through cultural osmosis. I could see that there was a diversity of Jewish opinion that existed about Israel that didn't seem to be reflected in the UK Jewish community. Or if it was, people seemed to keep their opinions to themselves, probably for fear of upsetting their friends or relations. At the same time, so this is the mid-1980s, I was reading lots of Holocaust histories. There was one that had just come out around 1985. Martin Gilbert, the British historian, wrote a very popular volume. And I was looking at personal testimonies of survivors like Primo Levi. All of this was kind of working its way through my head, slowly being processed into my identity as a late 20th century British Jew. Interestingly, the 1980s were the decade when the Holocaust and the State of Israel became kind of locked together in the public imagination. I can now see how this hinders rather than helps Jews and non-Jews to understand these critical events in Jewish history. I would still describe myself at this time as a liberal Zionist. That means I supported the State of Israel and believed the occupation of Gaza and the West Bank was the root of all the problems, and that the territory should be handed back to create a Palestinian state. That was still my position in 1996, when I returned to Israel for the second time, now as a news producer for BBC Radio 5 Live, working with presenter Eddie Mayer to cover the Israeli elections that took place in the aftermath of the assassination of Yitzhak Rabin by a Jewish extremist the previous year. Now, I have to admit that I still feel very guilty about my work on that particular assignment. What I failed to do, even though I had the opportunity, was to give a voice to Palestinians in either Israel or the occupied territories. This was despite the fact that they made up 20% of the electorate in Israel and were living under Israeli jurisdiction in the territories. Looking back, I can recognize the prejudice that I still had against Palestinians, even if I agreed with their central claim to have their own state. I was happy to set up interviews for Eddie with pro-peace Jewish Israelis, but not with Palestinians. There was still something stopping me from hearing Palestinian voices. I can now see how a deep-seated fear of the other, born out of a lifetime of being told that Palestinians were hell-bent on pushing the Jews into the sea and bringing on a second Holocaust, this was a barrier that I was yet to find a way to cross over. During the second Palestinian uprising that began in the year 2000, when the Oslo peace process had become a sham in the eyes of the Palestinians and the settlement building was racing ahead, Anne and I were busy running a small business and looking after three small children at our new home in Cumbria. We talked about wanting to visit Israel, but the combination of suicide bombings and massive Israeli retaliation in the occupied territories didn't make it look like the best place for a family holiday. I do remember feeling uncomfortable with the easy dismissal of suicide bombers as an example of the fanatical hatred of Jews that the Palestinians were teaching their children. There had to be something more to it than that. It also made me realize that there was very little point in going back to Israel again unless I could find a way to meet and talk to Palestinians. For me, 2008 and Israel's Operation Cast Lead in Gaza became the moment when I really re-engaged with the politics of Israel-Palestine. At the height of the Israeli offensive, my sister in London forwarded me an email from one of the UK-Israel solidarity organisations defending the level of force that was being used on the ground and in the air against Gazan civilians. It was the same rationale against the forces of Palestinian terrorism that I've been reading about in the Jewish Chronicle that was getting more and more irate. In reply, I sent my sister an article by Rabbi Michael Lerner. He's a rabbi from the States with a long tradition of Jewish ethically rooted dissent. And so we kind of played out our own little battle using proxies that were more articulate than ourselves and sort of emailing each other back and forth. And our proxies were doing the fighting for us, and we were kind of, you know, safe in the emotional security behind our computer screens. My sister and I have yet to have a proper conversation about Israel. We kind of stay clear of it because each of us recognize the power that the subject has to destroy relationships. From this point, I started to plug myself into the conflict, both in print and online. I read the works of the new wave of Israeli historians who've had to re-examine the circumstances of 1948 and the creation of the Palestinian refugees. And I began to read, for the first time, Palestinian memoirs and accounts as well. Then came Greenbelt. And alongside Billy Bragg on the programme was Mark Ellis, a Jewish theologian whose work I'd read over the years, particularly his efforts to articulate a Jewish liberation theology that reawakens the Jewish prophetic tradition to speak truth under power. His presence at Greenbelt that year inspired me back to his work with a heightened sensitivity to his message. Now, it was Anne that saw the email from the rather brilliant Amos Trust after Greenbelt that year, inviting applications from Greenbelters to join a journey to Israel-Palestine to hear from peacemakers from Christian, Muslim, and Jewish communities, and to see close up what life looks like for Palestinians on both sides of the 1967 Israeli borders. Now, despite being up to her eyes in studying for the priesthood and running the family home, Anne said we shouldn't pass up the chance to go. And as you can imagine, this trip turned out to be a critical turning point for me, and I'm quite sure there are many of you in this room who have had similar experiences and have gone to Israel and have come back really quite profoundly changed. One of the most disturbing encounters we had on the trip was with a settler from the town of Efrat on the West Bank who justified everything in the name of Judaism. In fact, he chose to speak to us in the community's synagogue. One of the last things he said to us was, "When you go home to Britain, you want to live in a British state, don't you? Or at least it used to be British." Now, there was that last throwaway comment that took a moment to register properly with me, and then I realised what had just been said to us. I thought about my train journey to work each day from Cumbria to Manchester, and my fellow commuters to the offices and schools in the city, the black British faces and the white British faces and the Muslim British faces and my own Jewish British face. What kind of face did he think Britain should have? What does a Jewish state mean in practice for him? What face does it have? That meeting just confirmed my existing views about the morality of the settlements and the damage they are causing to Israel and to Judaism. But as our visit drew to a close, we were brought face to face with another aspect of the Palestinian story that had a far greater impact on me. The Palestinians of Israel are a mostly forgotten community when discussing the Israel-Palestine conflict. But it was here that I felt the strongest emotion of the whole trip. We were in Nazareth, the largest majority Palestinian town in Israel, to meet Samuel and Susan Bahum. Samuel was the vicar of Christ Church in Nazareth, and Susan and Samuel are Palestinian Christians, Israeli citizens whose families have lived in Israel, Palestine for generations. The Bahums, without the slightest sense of anger or resentment in their voices, told us what it meant to them and their young children to be Palestinian citizens of Israel. Citizens who earn their living in Israel and pay their taxes to the Jewish state. And remember, Palestinians are 20% of Israel's population. They are the remnant of the Palestinians who were mostly expelled or driven out by fear during the 1947-48 conflict. Most ended up in refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Egypt. Those that remained were treated as present absentees, often losing their land and their homes and subject to military jurisdiction right up until the 1960s. 65 years ago, the State of Israel was created with the promise that it would, to quote from the Israeli Declaration of Independence, ensure complete equality of social and political rights to all its inhabitants, irrespective of religion, race, or sex. Well, the Palestinians are still waiting. They may have rights as individual citizens, but only the Jews have rights as a nationality. It sounds like a kind of technical distinction, but it makes all the difference. Israel is the state of the Jews, and not just those Jews that live there. It belongs to me as well. So much so that I have the right to settle there tomorrow, if I wish. However, the descendants of the Palestinian refugees, only a couple of generations removed from the land, have no such right of return. Despite the stated intention of the Israeli Declaration of Independence, every aspect of Palestinian life is disadvantaged compared to their Jewish Israeli neighbours. Susan and Samuel had plenty of first-hand experience to share with us. Education resources are consistently lower in Arab schools compared to Jewish schools. The school curriculum in the Arab schools disadvantages Palestinian students who then want to take exams to enter Israeli universities. Their exemption from joining the Israeli army, as most students must do automatically, then leaves them disadvantaged in the jobs market, including public services, where not having an army number has become a legitimate way to discriminate against Arabs. Meanwhile, the central government funding to develop and improve Palestinian neighbourhoods is vastly disproportionate compared to Jewish towns and neighbourhoods. In spite of all this, indeed because of it, Susan and Samuel were working hard to build bridges between Christians, Muslims and Jews, with interfaith projects particularly aimed at children and teenagers. Getting Jews involved, though, is particularly challenging, as Susan describes to us. And she said, Arabs and Jews are not friends. They don't want to connect with us. From talking to Susan, it was clear that from the Jewish-Israeli perspective, making friends and socializing with Arabs was not a priority. Why bother? What's the need? For the vast majority of Israeli Jews, maintaining a separation is the preferred standpoint. But worse than that is the casual as well as institutional racism that dominates Israeli society. Palestinian Arabs are the perennial other in Israel. They are at best tolerated and at worst seen as a fifth column, the enemy within. Standing outside the steps of Susan and Samuel's church, I knew I had finally had it with the whole Zionist project as it had been played out over the last 120 years. The problem was not 1967 and the occupied territories. It wasn't even 1947-48 and the circumstances around creating the State of Israel. Something in my head clicked into place in the last rags of my ultra-liberal Zionism fell to the ground. The Zionist project was fundamentally flawed from the very outset. Now, I felt a bit like Charlton Heston at this point, not playing Moses, but from the original Planet of the Apes film. Okay, I don't know whether you remember this film. You remember the last scene in the film, and he's kind of walking along the beach, and he sees the battered and broken Statue of Liberty washed up on the beach, and he realizes that he's not on some foreign, some alien planet. He's actually on his own planet Earth, and it's humankind's stupidity that has led to his current predicament. Okay, I can't do the Charlton Heston impersonation, but the words at the end of the scene, it kind of says, "You maniacs, you blew it up. Okay, oh damn you, God damn you all to hell." Okay, they weren't the words that were in my head at that moment, but the sentiment was kind of, you know, that was how I was feeling at that time. For me, in trying to find our Jewish salvation through a misguided return to an exclusive nationalism, we had blown up our own heritage and squandered what was important to us throughout our history. On the last night of the Amos Trust trip in Nazareth, I realized that I was ready to take my own small stand and start shouting, at least in a kind of quiet, introverted way, about the perversion of Jewish values brought about by a narrow Jewish nationalist agenda, an agenda that had sent the usually reliable Jewish ethical compass into some kind of spasm. Now, I suffer from a quaint naivety that makes me believe that words can actually make a difference. I do believe that the right words in the right order really can make the world a better place. Now, that it might be a prayer, it might be a song, a poem, it can be a speech. In my case, it was going to be a blog. And so I created Micah's paradigm shift, as Jill mentioned, in honor of the Hebrew prophet who managed to condense the whole of Judaism into an easy-to-remember strapline: act justly, love kindness, and walk humbly with God. The words appear so reasonable, but in reality they are just as radical and countercultural today as they were in Judea in the 8th century BCE. We worship the wrong things, we do not do justice, we do not show kindness, and we walk upon the earth with a haughty arrogance. As a border-walking, road-crossing, interfaithing Jew, I'm conscious that I'm writing from the edge of the mainstream Jewish community. But writing from the edge has its advantages. It leaves me free from tribal affiliations, but without abandoning tribal affections. My Jewish edginess allows me to walk away from religious or theological rivalries. Instead, I'm free to concentrate on commonality, the shared ground that overlaps between communities and faiths where open minds can meet. On Israel-Palestine, my Jewish edginess allows me to understand the collective Jewish narrative that sees Israel not as a normal country, but as a just answer, a messianic redemption for a people who have suffered thousands of years of exile, discrimination, oppression, and genocide. But my Jewish border-walking edginess allows me to step outside of that narrative as well, to question its presentation of Jewish history, theology, and politics. It allows me to enter the narrative of the Palestinian people and to be changed by that experience and that understanding. So, what have I been trying to say online, in my online space? What responsibilities have I taken on? To my Jewish readers, I want to say that our relationship with the Palestinian people will define our present and determine our future as much as theirs. Finding a just settlement to the conflict is the single most important issue facing Jews worldwide. Every other challenge is secondary. Judaism and Jewish history must break free of a Zionist narrative that has led us down an ethical dead end, which I believe is at violent odds with our own tradition. Currently, I see us living in a period of kind of collective denial, blaming everyone but ourselves for the way that Israel is viewed worldwide. Now, part of this is definitely due to the very long shadow of the Holocaust and a collective trauma that is still being healed, still playing itself out. On settlement expansion, with the current Israeli government coalition addicted to it, we should be shouting from the synagogue rooftops for it to end, rather than following the line of the government of Israel. In my view, we need to be an independent, self-confident Jewish diaspora and move beyond a kind of child-parent relationship with Israel. Israel can be a homeland for the Jewish people, but not to the exclusion or institutional discrimination of its non-Jewish inhabitants. All of this requires a new Jewish narrative and self-understanding. That narrative must acknowledge the historic appeal of Zionism and the tragedies that made it look like the best option for our future. The mid-20th century was a moment of profound existential threat for the Jewish people, and the full extent of that loss, not only in human life, but psychologically, culturally, spiritually, politically, is still impossible to calculate. But Zionism's fatal flaw was that it failed to take into account that Palestine was far from being a land without a people for a people without a land. A European colonialist approach to indigenous people, even justified through cultural heritage, was never going to succeed in the middle of the 20th century. We now have to incorporate the Palestinian story into our own narrative if we are to move forward. And the Palestinians must do the same. They will not resolve their trauma without understanding ours. And that's something I was hearing Sami Awad talking about. You may have heard him speak, a Palestinian Christian that's been at Greenbelt this weekend. So to my Christian readers, what am I trying to say? Well, stand by Christians in Israel and Palestine, listen to their experiences and stories, and be guided by their concerns. Recognize the historical role that Christianity has had in Jewish European history, and the responsibility that Christianity has in partnering Jews in efforts to heal that pain and trauma. Understand that the Holocaust continues to play itself out in Jewish self-understanding and behavior. Acknowledge that the land of Israel remains central to Jewish thinking, religiously, culturally, politically. Don't be intimidated by those Jewish establishments, though, that attempt to close down Christian support for Palestinians. Insist that Zionism is not Judaism, and criticism of Israel is not anti-Semitism. Show respect for Jewish history and self-understanding, but disrespect for actions that violate the human dignity of God's creation. I like to keep things interesting for myself and my readers. So if you have been following my blog at all in the last couple of years, you'd have read my cyberspace encounter with David Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister. You'd have read about how Jonah turned up in my sitting room last Yom Kippur to argue the case for settlers. You'd have seen how I've occupied the Passover Seder night liturgy, written open letters to the Israeli ambassador to London, and indeed defended Greenbelt against criticisms from the Jewish Board of Deputies. And probably most notice of all, the letter to Anne Frank that discusses what her legacy means today. There is, of course, a risk in all of this, apart from, of course, getting carried away with your own rhetoric. I do leave myself open to being accused of being a useful idiot and a willing stooge for the enemies of Israel and those that wish to be hateful of all things Jewish. Actually, most of the kind of more aggressive comments on the things that I write tend to turn up on other websites that cross-post them. However, I've not told Anne this one yet. I did have a comment posted on Thursday night, and it gave a link as well. And when I clicked through on the link, it took me through to a Jewish dating agency. I thought, okay, this is how they're trying to get their message. This is where I've gone wrong, yeah. These are all, though, attempts to destroy the messenger and avoid any engagement with the message itself. To me, it fits a pattern of collective trauma and collective denial mixed with a kind of moral blindness when it comes to the treatment of Palestinians. Just as Micah was, I am writing from the radical edge, walking along borders, crossing over roads, and hoping for interfaith conversations. I hope that one day Micah and I will both find ourselves not on the edge, but in the middle. In the meantime, I will attempt to rescue the Hebrew covenant, as I understand it, one blog post at a time. Thank you very much.
And thank you, Robert. I'm delighted we finally got him to speak. It's great. We have time for some questions, and we'll use this mic. So if you have questions, please come here. And when I think we've near time, I'll cut it off. So do we have anyone, people that want to come up?
You referred to this slightly at the end, but I wanted to know how you are received by mainstream Judaism and you know, are your readers mostly Jews or Christians or a mixture, and kind of what's been the response from sort of established Judaism?
Okay. I'll try and answer them quickly as we go along, I think. Might be, otherwise I'll forget what you've asked. Yes. It's actually quite hard to work out who's reading your stuff with a blog. Obviously, you can kind of see, you can look at the names on the email addresses that subscribe to you and try and kind of work out, is that a Jewish name? Is that a name? But it's hard to work it out. The reaction I get, on the whole, very supportive from a lot of people. A lot of people kind of get where I'm coming from. Obviously, some people find me very annoying and want to dismiss me. And plenty of people, I'm sure, just kind of ignoring me. I'm trying to remember the quote from Gandhi that says, you know, kind of first they ignore you, and then they kind of laugh at you, and then they start fighting you, and then you win, or something like that. So I kind of think I'm on some sort of journey like that.
My head is swarming with questions. I'm a Christian minister in an interfaith Jewish family. And I work in Canada in a Mohawk community, an Aboriginal community.
Wow.
Yeah. So
you need to give the talk next.
Well, no. but I have two questions for you, and I'll let you decide to which you want to answer. One is, what is your understanding around Judaism and the importance of land? Different religions have different relationship to land, as do Aboriginal communities, and I wondered if you wanted to speak anything about that. And the other question I have for you is perspectives on not only interfaith families or interfaith dialogue, but interfaith people, and where we go with that in conversation.
Can I choose the first one? I like the second one a lot, but I think it's massive. I was writing earlier in the summer about land and the way in which land theology comes into the whole kind of dialogue that happens at the moment around particularly Christian groups getting involved in campaigning on behalf of Palestine, and I tried to set out in that particular piece how the Jewish conception of land has been evolving over 3,000 years. It isn't a static thing, and you can read the kind of biblical promises in Genesis made to Abraham, but it doesn't stop at that point. If you carry on, you know, you carry on reading the Hebrew Bible, and you see how the understanding of that promise changes. It's the way it's articulated within Deuteronomy around it becomes conditional for a start. You know, the land that God is giving the land, but there are conditions attached to it, which is about upholding the law. When you start moving on beyond that, you also get the kind of prophetic tradition that's clearly saying that God is universal. God isn't just in this one place. And then, of course, the whole 2,000 years of Jewish diaspora, the rabbis had to work out, well, how do we understand Judaism when we're not living on the land? So land theology didn't stop. You know, it didn't stop with the promise to Abraham, as if they know that was the end of the story. You know, God said, this land is yours. It evolved. It evolved and it changed, and our rabbis had to rethink it, and it gets, you know, it's evolving within the Hebrew scriptures.
I'm a Indian English Christian. I grew up in India, and then I came back to this country, and my best friend in the sixth form is a Jewish woman, and I'm thinking, if I want to marry my best friend, can I still be a Christian? She didn't want to marry me, but I still have questions about my security. Is it in being a Christian? Is it in anything else? Having a patch of land or not? And also, I think, becoming very aware that I need to be able to let go of elements of my identity or my rationality that have defended things that actually get up other people's noses so far that it kills them. Now, am I pushing the thing up their nose, or are they pushing it themselves? But I've been very encouraged, and I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about the sense of having to abandon our grip on what we think God is, so that we can be human together.
Now, it's a very profound question. I suspect I'm not going to give you as a profound an answer. I do think that I'm a religious pluralist, so I believe that there are different traditions are all kind of striving towards the same questions in different ways. And I also think, I look around the world, you look at nature and creation and you just see diversity, don't you? You just say, God clearly wants diversity. Why are there so many different, species of ants? Or, why are there so many trees? That's what works. So, and I think about this in religious terms as well. There's good reasons why different people in different parts of the world have evolved different religious traditions and understanding. And I kind of think that's a good thing. In terms of my understanding of religious pluralism, I'm not wanting to create some kind of mushy mess of a religion that somehow sort of bolts everything together. I think there is great value in having that diversity. But yeah, we have to kind of work how to speak to each other, where to find the points of commonality, because I think we're all in it together, really. There's far more in common than there is in disagreement, and you choose where you want to put the emphasis. Hello, Mark.
I'm trying very hard to try to figure out a clever way to combine two questions into one. You'll sort it out.
Okay.
The first question I wanted to ask you was a very short one, which is, what do you think about BDS? And I really would like you to address that. The second, which I think sort of relates to it, is I'm positive that you must have the same experience as I do, which is that multitudes of people come up to you at different times and in different places, Christians who say, what do I do about the fact that my relationship with my best friend, Jewish friend of 25 years, is coming apart because of this situation, or my son-in-law who's Jewish and it's threatening to blow up the family. And people ask me for advice, and I'm always floored by that. I'm just wondering what you think about that and how you deal with that in your own experience.
Okay, thank you. BDS, I do support the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. And I support that kind of in its entirety. So I know you can choose whether you want to just kind of opt into it in a more limited fashion. So that might be not purchasing goods from the settlements on the West Bank. But I've thought about it a lot, and I thought, well, the problem isn't actually the settlers on the West Bank. The problem is the entire Israeli government that has allowed that to happen over the last 45 years. So it's not a kind of I'm not keen on the settlers. But they could only have done what they've done if they had the entire country was kind of geared towards that project. So so my view is that the situation is serious enough that, and we've kind of run out of time, I think, in terms of the any other approaches. We look at the peace negotiations that are now underway, sponsored by John Kerry, and I'm thinking, well, they're going to go nowhere. No, because it's the same parameters of the discussion that's been going for more than 20 years. Why do we suddenly think it's going to work this time round? It won't. I'm waiting to see really how that will fizzle out. And I'm hoping that whatever comes at the end of the breakdown of those peace talks won't be another horrible kind of violent incidents. But I fear that might be what happens at the end of it. So my support for BDS is kind of in its entirety, and I've reached that view because I think it's a non-violent way of showing of ordinary people around the world showing that they are not happy with what's going on. And I do think it's only going to be through a kind of grassroots community action that politicians will actually start to shift their views on this. I like Barack Obama, great guy. I was all for him when he was first running for president. But I've seen how even somebody of Obama's background and views on Israel cannot even put the slightest significant pressure on Israel to even stop sort of building settlements while talks are underway. You can't even do that. So I think nothing, the dynamic isn't going to change unless the politicians realise that there is a sea change in the way electors actually think about the issue, just as there was in South Africa in the mid-1980s. The politicians were the last people to change their minds. It's only when, you know, people like us started sort of kicking up a fuss and showing that we weren't happy with this that they realised, oh, it's actually a political vote winner to come out and be, you know, against apartheid in South Africa. And I'm afraid that, you know, that's where I think we've got to with Israel Palestine. I'm not relying on Barack Obama to solve it for me anymore. I was kind of hoping he might do, but now I know that's never going to happen. And if he can't do it, then no American president will ever be able to do it. So that's where I am on BDS. On the friends question mark. Where I see this most often is actually within my own family. I mentioned my sister. My parents are, maybe this is the difference between parents and siblings. You know, parents are very indulgent, you know, to their children. So you kind of, you know, you give them a lot of space and you want to be supportive even if you don't agree with them. So my mum and dad have always been, you know, they haven't given me too hard a time on the things I've been writing. Either that or my dad hasn't worked out how to turn his computer on. So he hasn't been reading most of it. But anyway, but they're very supportive. Siblings, I think, are tend to be far less tolerant of each other. And I've kind of had to make the decision up to this point about, you know, do I want to kind of, am I willing to kind of give up those family relationships? Because it's really hard. My niece, my sister's daughter, has been very active in Jewish youth groups over the years. In fact, she led a birthright tour. Don't you know what that means? Birthright tours. This is Jewish charities. They raise money so that Jewish youngsters or young Jewish adults get the chance to go to Israel. And the idea was to kind of, you know, give them a kind of very pro-Israel as an advocacy program, and they can go there. They don't have to pay for the trip. You know, it's paid for, and they can go there. But you know, if you're a Palestinian, who's, you know, perhaps your grandfather might have been born in Jerusalem, but you can't go back there. I just see, you know, those trips just seem, I don't know, in my mind, quite outrageous that they even exist. So I have to work out a way. How am I going to talk to Katie, my niece, about this subject? And I do find it really difficult. So I recognise exactly the dilemma that you're describing, Mark. And at some point, I'm going to have that conversation.
Hello. Undoubtedly, the Jewish people have a right to dwell in that area. Undoubtedly, the indigenous peoples that are there have a right to dwell in that area. Way back when Moses led Israel there, there were indigenous peoples there. So is it too much to expect that instead of keeping chopping up the area, give that to Palestinians there, and down there on the coast, that to Palestinians there, that they could coexist within one country and one parliament? Because already there are, correct me if I'm wrong numerically, there are 1 million Arabs living within Israel, as it's called now, who have a voice in the Knesset. Why cannot there be a complete country there rather than chopping everything up? And the answer doesn't seem to be coming from politicians, but I think it's going to have to come from grassroots for that to actually happen. But that seems to be, in my simple little mind, the only solution.
I think we're talking about, you know, is it a two-state solution, a one-state solution? My preference is ultimately I would like to see one state that encompasses, you know, from the Mediterranean through across to the border with Jordan. How we get there, I'm not exactly sure, whether it starts off as two states maybe or evolves into some kind of, you know, confederation. But it's a tiny piece of land. You know, we're not talking about a big area. You know, it doesn't really make kind of sense in my mind to try and kind of divide it up. And certainly kind of in terms of the deal that seems to be on the table at the moment, the Palestinians don't get much of a state anyway. And a lot of people say, well, you've got a one state now. you know, it's a one state that's ruled by Israel, which is kind of how I see it. So ultimately, I would like it to be one state, a democratic state, but one that recognizes the rights and religions and views of all of its citizens.
Thank you for coming, and again, thank you, Robert, for sharing with us your path. And again, I would commend Micah's paradigm shift. It's brilliant. Thank you. Thank you.